central Ukrainian city treats dozens of wounded civilians one day after a deadly Russian missile strike on civilian buildings.
Today, Vinnytsia is still shocked, and huge destructions are in the city, but rescue operation is almost done.
Plus, an exiled Belarusian opposition figure tells us how the Belarusian president is enabling Russia's aggression against Ukraine.
When we speak right now about Belarus, we must understand that decisions of Lukashenko does not reflect the will of Belarusian people.
And later in the program, we'll hear from a Ukrainian medical doctor living in the U.S. about his project to send medical supplies to hospitals suffering from shortages back in his hometown. Today is Friday, July 15th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Michael Lippin, filling in for Steve Miller. Authorities in Ukraine's west-central city of Vinnytsia were wrapping up a search operation on Friday, one day after a deadly missile strike on civilian buildings in what had otherwise been a relatively peaceful part of the country. I asked reporter Anna Chernikova in Kyiv for the latest details on casualties from the attack.
According to the latest report that we have from the police and from the rescue team, 23 people were killed, including 3 children who were at that moment in the city center. We know that one child was in the hospital, which was located on the first floor of the business center, and this child was waiting for certain treatment with his mother. Both of them were killed. For the moment, we know that over 100 people are receiving medical treatment. 82 of them are receiving this treatment in the hospital. So their situation and their condition is quite serious. We know that 5 people are in a critical condition. For the moment, there are still 8 people who were not recognized, and DNA procedures are taking place. Today, Vinnytsia is still shocked, and huge destructions are in the city, but rescue operation is almost done. According to President Zelensky, this is another war crime committed by Russian forces. Russian Ministry of Defense confirmed that they actually committed this attack. They say that this attack was targeting cultural center where, according to them, international partners of Ukraine who provide Ukraine with military equipment had a meeting and all of them were destroyed. There is no confirmation of this information. And according to what we know from Ukrainian official sources and from Vinnytsia officials, this place was not a place for any meetings. It was just a cultural center where concerts and theater operas were taking place.
So, Anna, what information do you have about the latest Russian missile attacks in different parts of Ukraine today?
Today, Ukraine woke up with 10 explosions in the city of Mykolaiv. 10 Russian missiles hit 2 biggest universities of Mykolaiv. We know that a couple of people were injured, according to the latest report from the rescue team. We don't have any information regarding casualties, so we're going to wait for that. Also, today in the morning, almost the same time, the city of Kharkiv was under missile attack. Also, educational institutions were hit. So today, what Ukrainian officials commented on that today Russian forces decided to concentrate their attacks on the educational institutions. Unfortunately, the university in Mykolaiv was completely destroyed, and unfortunately, this attack on the education institution is not the first one that Russian forces commit.
Reporter Anna Chernikova, thank you for bringing us up to date from Kyiv.
Thank you, Michael.
For some historical perspective on Russia's war against Ukraine, VOA Georgian Service journalist Annie Chigvadze spoke this week with Elliot Cohen, a military historian and professor at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. She asked Cohen about the significance of the latest Russian offensives.
The first thing you have to say is that we're seeing a kind of very intense, sustained combat, the kind that we really haven't seen since World War II. And it's not something that Western militaries have experienced, or the Russian military has experienced for decades and decades. Second thing is the Russians have made a number of attempts to do the kind of grand encircling operations which characterized their war on the Eastern Front in World War II. And each time they've had to kind of pull back these efforts to encircle. And at the end of the day, they haven't been able to pull any of it off. What they've been able to do is pour in a vast amount of artillery and rocket fire, completely destroy cities, and then after a number of attempts, finally get their infantry to occupy the ruins at very, very heavy cost. So what you're really seeing is the Russians inching forward. They're not gaining any really sort of decisive positions. I mean, they're inflicting damage and they're occupying small towns. What the Ukrainians have been doing is, you know, a kind of classic elastic defense where you give up terrain, but you make the other guy pay for it very heavily. This is a war of attrition. And at the moment, the Russians have been suffering quite heavy attrition. Now, they're going to try to make up for that. But that's what it looks like now.
And, you know, when you look at 5 months of the war right now, and you mentioned that this is now a war of attrition, do you see this turning into a, you know, very long-term conflict? Is there a state where it may be too costly for Russia to continue this war?
Well, again, nobody can tell what course this war will take. And I think that what everybody needs to understand is there are several possibilities. One, sort of a stalemate. Second, I suppose, would be a slow Russian victory. But I think, you know, another possibility, which, you know, I can't assess what the probability is, but it's certainly a possibility that you begin to see major unit collapses. That is to say, mass surrenders, combat refusal, mutiny, desertion, those kinds of things. There have been some signs of that before now. But I think if the Russians suddenly lose their ability to deliver vast quantities of fire, all they're left with are a bunch of pretty demoralized and poorly trained infantry at a very diminished armored corps. And then you could see that sort of thing happen. You know, in theory, you could imagine the Ukrainians suffering that. But I tend to think it's less likely. I mean, they know what they're fighting for, and they're fighting an existential battle. This is not an existential battle for Russian soldiers.
With the military aid that's coming from the West, would Ukraine be able to deoccupy the cities that Russia has already taken?
So the test is going to be the city of Kherson, where the Ukrainians have been having local successes in the area. They've also had successes in terms of partisan-style resistance around the city and within the city. And there, that seems to be where the Ukrainians are focusing their efforts, and we will see. But I think it's certainly within the realm of possibility. The Ukrainians really have the Ukrainians have several challenges. One is they're absorbing a lot of Western technology of various types. It takes some time to train people on those, and also they're all somewhat different, and so they have rather complicated logistics. The other thing, and we just don't really have any evidence one way or the other on this, is whether the Ukrainians, who've been terrific on the defense, have the operational level skills of conducting large offensive operations. And we just don't know. I mean, I think any informed military observer looking at what the Ukrainians have done so far can't help but be very impressed. But that's a different kind of mission than the one that they've had so far.
And, you know, when we talk about Ukraine and counterattack, what would a win for Ukraine in this situation look like? What do you think? Like, is it retaking the south? Is it retaking the Donbas or going back to February 24? Or what is an Ukrainian win in the current, considering the battlefield?
So in the, you know, in the near term, I think liberating Kherson, taking some of the coast back would be major victories, major in terms of their consequences, things like helping to free up Ukrainian grain exports, but also a major psychological boost for the Ukrainians. And not just it would make them feel better, but I think it would it would make it more likely that they would continue to get very large quantities of Western support. I think the difficult goal, but not inconceivable, is pushing the Russians back roughly to the 24 February line. The Ukrainians have been talking about going all the way and taking back those parts of Donbass that were occupied by the Russians, and even taking Crimea. I think that'll be much more difficult, particularly trying to take Crimea back. You know, there's just a sort of a limited number of roads. I think there are just two roads that go into Crimea. And you have to think that it would be hard for the Ukrainians to break through. But, you know, we don't know. One of the challenges with this war is the two sides really want such utterly incompatible things. I mean, the Russians still seem to want to take all of Ukraine. And the Ukrainians still, you know, have made it clear that they want to liberate all of their soil. So that means that this war could go on for quite some time.
That was Elliot Cohen of the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies speaking with my VOA Georgian colleague, Annie Chikvadze. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Michael Lippin. Russia's close ally and neighbor Belarus has been a key player in Russian President Vladimir Putin's war against Ukraine. While Belarusian troops have not entered the war themselves, Belarus has allowed Russian forces to use its territory in various ways. Franek Viachorka is a senior political advisor to exiled Belarusian opposition leader Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya. I asked him what Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko is currently doing to enable Russia's aggression.
Russia is using Belarus as the aircraft carrier, as a launching pad for attacking Ukraine. We saw it in February and March when Russian tanks, vehicles massively moved in the direction of Kyiv. But in April, May, and June, tactics was changed. Now, we don't see Russian vehicles coming to Ukraine from Belarus territory by land, but they are actively using airspace. They are launching aviation from Russian airfields. They enter Belarusian airspace and launch missiles towards Ukraine, Zhytomyr, Kyiv, Chernihiv regions, which are strategically important and which are neighboring regions to Belarus. Putin is very happy to have such ally who became a de facto collaborator in this war. We can compare Lukashenko to Marshal Petain in occupied France during Second World War. He formally, Lukashenko preserved signs of independence, but de facto he implements all the decisions and all the orders given from the capital, from Moscow. Basically, Lukashenko gave up critical parts of Belarus sovereignty, defense, territory, and foreign relations, foreign policy. And when we speak right now about Belarus, we must understand that decisions of Lukashenko does not reflect the will of Belarusian people.
So then what is influencing the Belarusian president Lukashenko to go along with all of Putin's plans? What are the greatest factors behind his decision making?
Lukashenko understands that this is the only way to stay in power, to get Putin's support. Without Putin's support, Lukashenko wouldn't survive the revolution which started in 2020. The protests that followed fraudulent elections. Putin basically saved Lukashenko from political death. And right now, Lukashenko is paying back the debt. He allowed Putin to do whatever he wants. And he realizes that he is a puppet. He realizes that he is not independent anymore. But he also realized that he is cornered and he doesn't have any other choice than to serve Putin. I think Lukashenko feels that his political influence on Belarus is very limited right now. His support base is limited to Siloviki, group of officials, some army people and KGB, but he doesn't control the majority of population. And Putin is like the guarantee, it's like the backup plan. It's like the safe guard that the power of Lukashenko will remain in place in Belarus.
So the Russians have spoken about how they see, you know, Belarus as essentially part of the same nation as their country. Given that Lukashenko is so dependent on support from Putin now, as you describe it, what is stopping Lukashenko from just handing over the keys of the country to Putin?
Personal ambitions. Lukashenko wants to be in charge. He wants to be in media. He wants to be discussed. He likes himself. He likes himself in power. Just imagine if you're in power for 28 years, you can't imagine your life without it. Also, Lukashenko has a fear that when something will change in Belarus, he, his family, his sons, his grandchildren, they will be persecuted, and they will probably be for all the crimes Lukashenko committed, not just in relation to war in Ukraine, but for 28 years, disappearances of politicians, dozens of thousands of people put in jail illegally, many people killed. Lukashenko understands that at some point he will face justice, and he tries to postpone this moment so long as possible. Of course, he would love to play again this geopolitical seesaw like he was playing for many, many years. But this CISO doesn't work anymore. And this is why, you know, he fully chose Moscow as the only direction to go.
You are listening to Franek Viatorka, a senior advisor to Belarus's exiled opposition leader, speaking to me from the Lithuanian capital, Vilnius. When Russia began its full-scale invasion of Ukraine earlier this year, a Ukrainian doctor based in the U.S. Midwestern state of Wisconsin quickly recruited a team to send supplies to hospitals in his hometown of Dnipro in east-central Ukraine. The doctor, Vladislav Diev, spoke with me about how the project started and how he was able to turn it into an organization with U.S. nonprofit status in just a matter of weeks.
So on February 24th, I opened up the news from Ukraine and I saw that the war started. I called my parents immediately who live in that very city. And it was a lot of shock in the first day or two. But the next thing I did, I called my friends and I said, you know, how can I help and how we can all help Ukraine and stand with Ukraine? Because we are not soldiers, but what we can do is we can provide different kind of support. So one of my friends, he's an attorney, another one is business executive, and the third one is IT specialist. So we all are native to Dnipro, and we know a lot of people there who work in the hospitals. And we decided to focus on hospitals because this is my area of expertise, and this is where we all have had a lot of personal connections.
Can you tell us what kinds of assistance you have been providing to the hospitals in Dnipro so far and how you've been providing them assistance?
The way things work in Ukraine oftentimes is that you have to just know the right people. And unfortunately, that's how it has been for so long. And we all hope for the change in the future. But what happened is essentially I called people who work in those hospitals and ask, what do you need? What we can bring you? And simple things like antiseptic, gauze, wound wax, which is basic medical equipment, was lacking. So initially we went around warehouses in Dnipro, and a lot of their medical equipment was already repurposed to the military. But whatever was left, we just purchased it. And the next thing we did, we went to Poland and we found some connections there. And on personal cars, we transported it over to Ukraine. So there are three main hospitals that we partnered with. And we delivered, you know, simple things like crutches for soldiers who couldn't ambulate, wound vacs, again, antiseptic, gauzes, medications, whatever they needed at the very moment, we were just there to help them.
How have you been able to fund these types of aid to Ukraine?
So again, because I have been through medical training here in the United States, I have a lot of friends and different hospitals here. And I just asked for help on a social media. One of my former students, in the first hour or so, he donated $1,000. And I called him and said, you know, Wei, his name is Wei Zhao. I'm like, Wei, why are you donating $1,000? You're just a medical student. You're beyond broke. He's like, oh, I think that if other people see medical student donating $1,000 for Ukraine, they will be embarrassed to give less. And that was just an eye-opening experience to me. You know, people just were so responsive, and they saw what we were doing, and they gathered funds in my own hospitals where I work. The nurses, they contributed to our cause. And we were able to gather pretty quickly about $20,000.
What are some of the challenges of running a relatively small nonprofit like yours and, you know, getting attention and support for what you're doing?
Yeah, so when we started off, we have a website pretty quickly just to tell people about how the money are spent. And that website was helpukrainianhospitals.org. However, we updated it, and the more recent version is called helpukrainianhospitals.com. The main challenges that we face, so initially, we were able to collect substantial amount of money, at least for our purposes, because our help is mostly local, pretty quickly. And after a month or two have passed, obviously the enthusiasm about helping Ukraine has faded. And understandably so, there are many bad things that happen in the world and things shift attention. So right now, our main challenges as a small organization is that keep drawing that kind of attention to our causes. And our causes are relatively small. We are not providing a large scale aid kits or any type of support at a large scale. We mainly help people from our own local community where I grew up and other founders grew up. We provide help to kind of our own where it's needed. And this help is usually relatively small. So we were unable to fulfill certain requests lately because of lack of funding. So right now, our main challenge is to collect more resources and more large-scale help. And that's why our focus more recently was on providing things like mental health services, for example, that are requiring less funding as opposed to medical supplies, or maybe food that is relatively cheap in Ukraine. And work on marketing strategy to attract more large-scale medical equipment manufacturers and maybe large-scale organizations to help us to provide this help at local level.
Well, Vladislav Diev, president of Help Ukrainian Hospitals, thank you for speaking to Flashpoint Ukraine about what your organization is doing, and I wish you good luck.
Thanks for having me, Michael. I appreciate your time.
That brings us to the end of today's program. There's more VOA coverage of Ukraine 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and on our social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. On behalf of the Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. I'm Michael Lippin. Good night from Washington, and have a great weekend.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.